This is a best of edition of Sandy Rios in the Morning.
It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
Governor Baker was welcomed to the GOP convention stage with applause and hugs, then used his speech to support lowering the sales tax, giving the death penalty to cop killers, and helping federal officials deport undocumented immigrants.
We need a strong United Republican Party to serve as a check on those Democrat majorities.
But in the crowd, a woman holding a cutout of President Trump called Baker a liar and a traitor. And others held up signs accusing him of being a Republican in name only.
I'm voting for pro-life candidates who stand up for the unborn.
I'm 100% pro-life.
Scott Lively, a pastor from Springfield, said he opposes abortion, supports gun rights, and believes President Trump has done almost everything right.
There is only one man in this nation that's responsible for the economic miracle that we've experienced since the election of 2016. That's our president, Donald Trump.
After the speeches, delegates cast votes on computer tablets, and then the results were announced.
For Charlie Baker, 1,577 votes.
Baker's nearly 70% is enough to win the delegates' official endorsement, but Lively scored nearly 28%, enough to qualify for a Republican runoff in September. Baker declined to say if he'll debate Lively.
On Monday, I'm going back to work as governor of the Commonwealth, and that is going to be my focus for the time being, because we have a lot to do. I did not answer the question.
Lively predicted the president will campaign with him.
I think I'll be on the Trump radar, especially because it's here in Massachusetts.
In Worcester, David Beanick, WCVB, News Center 5.
All right, Sandy Rios with you. And that, of course, was a radio television station out of Boston that happened just last week. And the reason I'm bringing it to your attention is because Massachusetts has been central to so much of what has happened in this country since 2003. I'll explain that more fully later. But the person I want to introduce you to you is kind of a central figure in all that has happened. And you heard his name mentioned on that clip. It's Dr. Scott Lively. He won 28% of the delegate vote in the Republican convention in Massachusetts just last week, which means when you understand who he is, you'll understand how truly incredible that is. He joins me this morning. Good morning, Scott. How are you?
I'm great, Sandy. How you doing?
I'm doing very well. If you were to describe, you know, you go around now Massachusetts and you're shaking hands, I'm confident, introducing yourself, who do you tell people that you are?
I tell them I'm a constitutional law attorney and a pastor who stands on true Republican principles.
When you say you're a pastor, how's that part greeted?
Well, it's actually well received by most people. I'm respected. Even those that are bashing me acknowledge that I stand on the Bible. I'm not afraid. I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Everybody knows that here in Massachusetts, whether they agree with me or not. And I've had the privilege of being able to stand for biblical values here in Massachusetts for quite a long time, and to speak truth and shine light really into the darkest sphere of our society, which is the political arena. And now I'm actually have the prospect of being able to run against Mr. Baker in the Republican primary as a Republican, not as an independent.
It's interesting to me that Massachusetts has a Republican governor, but I guess it shouldn't, because Republican Governor Mitt Romney was presiding when gay marriage was passed, which we'll get into.
They're not really Republicans, though, Sandy. They're not really Republicans. They're Democrats in Republican clothing. The Republican Party in Massachusetts hasn't been Republican at the top for probably 30 years since Bill Weld was governor. And it's got increasingly more left-wing, you know, every single election cycle.
So what, but I'm surprised, though, that a Democrat is not governor. I mean, at least they don't have to disguise anything. It seems like a Democratic candidate would exemplify the values of Massachusetts more readily. That, explain that to outsiders, how that happens.
Well, it's the reason that Massachusetts is so deep blue isn't because there aren't conservatives in the state. There's quite a lot of us. It's because the system is controlled by the far left. The way this works in Massachusetts is really the exemplar of this, but it's all over the country, really, that the Democrats pose as champions of the disadvantaged. They then demand money from the federal government to take care of the disadvantaged, money that they control. They use that money to build a gigantic infrastructure of permanent socialist voters who are public employee union members. And then they pay them off by negotiating contracts with them that give them massive unfunded benefits from the public treasury. It's a corrupt, self-perpetuating system that's hard to break. But when you actually present a authentic conservative voice, that voice gets elected. Ronald Reagan won Massachusetts in 80 and 84. He's the only Republican to have done it since Eisenhower. And because he's the only one who stood solidly on a pro-life, overtly Christian, populist conservative platform, like I am.
You know, let me ask you about that, because I was, one of the things as I was just thinking about talking to you on the air, I thought, now what in the world do you lay out as your platform if you're running in Massachusetts and you are a conservative? And I have to say, Scott, before we even get into the details here, you go right at it. Let's just hear you. What is it that you are? I see it on your website, but I'll let you verbalize it. What is your platform in Massachusetts?
Well, I'm a full spectrum conservative, but the three things that are going to win me the governorship in Massachusetts, and I believe that it's actually possible that that's going to happen, and maybe even likely. If I can build a big enough army of grassroots, that is pro-life, pro-Second Amendment, and pro-Trump. Those are the three key things that the conservatives care about. There's a huge pro-life contingency that reached way into the Catholic, and this is a strongly Catholic state, always has been, or at least has been since the 30s, 1930s. And then the Second Amendment, Second Amendment is kind of a catch-all for all the people concerned about the disintegration of our constitutional rights. And the Second Amendment is the one that gets people most agitated who are populist in orientation, that crosses over into sort of traditional conservative. And then the pro-Trump, Donald Trump has brought together the Ronald Reagan coalition at the federal level, and people either love him or they hate him, and the ones that love him are passionate populist conservatives who have boundless energy and are looking for just any way to stop the global elites from, you know, taking down this country. They want the swamps drained, and they work very hard to make that happen. I think those three groups alone. But then there are other issues that I'm concerned about. I am a full spectrum conservative, and I speak to all those issues. But those are the three that I think are the most important.
Yeah, let me add to from your list on your website: in sanctuary cities, fight corruption.
Yes.
Restart manufacturing.
Yes.
Restore the family. Heal opioid addicts. Shrink the government. Defend the Constitution. So those are some of the other things that you are leading on. Scott, I'm curious about your current governor, Charlie Baker. What specific grievances do conservatives have with him?
Charlie Baker is a Democrat in Republican clothing. Everything he does in terms of conservatism is just posturing. Like, for example, he takes the position that, oh, he's against the Massachusetts becoming a sanctuary state. But he's fully endorsed the sanctuary cities and received and accepted endorsements from some of the worst sanctuary city mayors in the whole United States. And it's just pandering. he offered, this is actually the issue that got me in. When I saw that Charlie Baker promised Planned Parenthood to replace any money that they lost from congressional action stripping their funding because of their involvement in the scandal of baby parts harvesting and marketing, he promised to resupply them from our state tax funds for anything they lost because of that. And this is, of course, after the scandal was known to everybody. Wow. And on fiscal issues, he's actually, I don't know if people know anything about the Big Dig. This is from, goes back to the 90s. The Big Dig is the biggest financial boondoggle in the history of the United States, perhaps in the history of the world. Something like $40 billion for a public works project that we're still paying off because Charlie Baker, the mastermind of the payment plan to pay the thing off, was to take all of our highway and federal transportation funds and to dedicate it to the Big Dig from 1994, and it's still not paid off, and all of our roads and bridges are literally crumbling right beneath our cars every single day, and they were already bad back in the mid-90s. So all these things, on every single issue in which he postures as a conservative, he's actually a far-left liberal. He just put forward the biggest budget in Massachusetts history, right? This is not a conservative guy in any respect.
All right, so there's a clear difference. And you just won 28% of the delegates at the Republican convention. But then I was curious, I see that you are not still on the ballot, though. How does that happen, and what are you having to do to get on the ballot?
Well, every candidate in Massachusetts at the state level has to get 10,000 nominating signatures, and that's certified signatures. So you actually have to collect, you know, $14,000-$15,000 to be sure to get past all of the ones that
you mean signatures
qualified.
Fourteen to fifteen thousand signatures. Yeah.
Today at 5 o'clock is the deadline for submitting those signatures. My best guess at this point is that we've turned in about 14,000 raw, and that's really right on the borderline. I covet your prayers regarding getting over that threshold. But even if I didn't qualify, I'm not going away. I would run as a write-in candidate because what the most valuable contribution that I can make in this election, it's unlikely that I would beat him anyway. Just he's got $7 million and he's got a huge campaign infrastructure, and all the Democrats are going to vote for him. So winning against him would be literally a miracle. But my contribution is to build the conservative base, take the Republican Party back away from the Democrats, and to build a grassroots army to take the legislature back in 2020, and to get the whole conservative slate elected in this election. And if I do happen to make the ballot for running against Mr. Baker, I think there is a realistic possibility that I could beat him based on the plan that I'm projecting in terms of building this conservative base.
Part of your effort, as I understand it, is to register new conservative voters,
We used to have parity in Massachusetts. We had 50-50 parity with the Democrats years ago, 40 years ago. And when the party went left, all the conservatives, or most of them, they just left the party. They went unenrolled or they just stopped voting. And so there's huge numbers of people that just never vote conservatives because they're just disgusted and there's never anybody that actually stands up. Romney was not a conservative really either. He was more conservative than Baker is, but he's the guy who put through gay marriage here, which he didn't have to.
And Scott,
is responsible for, you know, $50 abortions.
Yeah, let me interrupt you because we have to take a break. But when we come back, we're going to actually go back in time because I want people to really fully understand who you are in this drama that's played out in Massachusetts. We haven't even touched on that. And so let's do that. Our guest is Dr. Scott Lively, who's running for governor in the state of Massachusetts. Stay tuned. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
You're listening to a best of edition of Sandy Rios in the morning.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
This is a best of edition of Sandy Rios in the morning.
This country was founded on the principles of freedom and equality, and today, Supreme Judicial Court, led by this courageous woman, Justice Marshall, has interpreted the law correctly and given freedom its true meaning in Massachusetts, and we're really proud to be from here, and we're really proud to have her as a Supreme Court Justice.
Yeah, once again, Massachusetts is making history. Yeah, always has and always will. I think everyone's really enjoying the moment. And one thing I really like about this is that everyone's doing it a little differently. Some people are getting married like today. Other people are waiting to get the license. Other people, we're getting the license today, but we're getting married in June. Everyone's doing it a little differently, which is really nice. I really feel like all the opponents are going to kind of die off over the next year and a half. I think they're going to realize that the sky is not going to fall. Life's going to go on. Straight people will still get married. You know, life will, you know, keep going the way it always has been. So I don't think it's going to, I hope it won't.
I said, I think we should go and get married. Is it just what we should do? And I said, well, I don't really think I want to get married just to make a political statement. But we went through lots of different reasons and decided, you know, we've been together for 9 years and we love each other very much, and we just wanted to have the protections and the and the rights of married people.
All right, that's a report from Human Rights Campaign, and that really takes many of us back in time. It was 14 years ago, May the 17th of 2004, when Massachusetts became the first state in the union to embrace gay marriage. I remember it well because I remember going up to Massachusetts trying to lobby Mitt Romney when he was governor at the time, talking to his staff as I was president of Concerned Women for America, trying to stop this. Many of us were doing everything we could. I remember speaking in Boston Commons with the Cardinal at a huge rally, thousands of people. I remember talking to Faneuil Hall. We were doing everything we could to stop Massachusetts from going in this direction. And the story of how that happened is really one of the greatest tragedies, and Mitt Romney really is a central character in this, and not a good one. But there was another central character in this, and there are lots of wonderful people in Massachusetts. You've heard me talk to Brian Kamiker of Mass Resistance, which was born out of this opposition effort. But Scott Lively was also a central figure in this, and he's my guest today. He's running for governor now in Massachusetts, which is pretty astounding. But Scott, where were you? Okay, let's just do this. On May 17th of 2004, where were you, and what was that day like for you?
Well, actually, I was in California at the time. I was heavily involved, but I was involved in the battle that preceded the so-called gay marriage ruling, and that was the Lawrence versus Texas case, because I was running a public interest law firm in Southern California, and we were the only law firm in the United States that asked the Supreme Court not to take the Lawrence versus Texas case. That was the case that actually struck down Bowers versus Hardwick, Antonin Scalia's landmark case that had recognized the right of states to regulate sexual conduct in the public interest. And Lawrence versus Texas deliberately overruled and struck down Bowers versus Hardwick and paved the way for the gay marriage ruling. And it wasn't an inevitable thing, but they just simply used it as a springboard. And so the very next thing, and of course we knew this is what they were going to do, and of course it had to be Massachusetts because it's the bluest of the blue states. And so it was really a foregone conclusion. Simply, no matter what we did to try to stop it, it was never going to happen, because the elites in this country are absolutely determined to push this agenda through, and they have been all along. And the number one culprit in all of this is not the Massachusetts judge that was just being interviewed there. It's Anthony Kennedy, the Supreme Court justice, who is now poised to retire, and poised, I think he's going to rule against us a sixth time, writing the majority opinion in the cake baking case that's now before them. He is single-handedly established supremacy, cultural supremacy in America. He wrote the majority opinion in Romer v. Evans. He wrote the majority opinion in Lawrence versus Texas, in Obergefell. All of these cases that steadily, step by step, completely dismantled the Judeo-Christian premise of our law. And the very last step before he retires is the right of free speech on the issue. And I'm predicting that he's going to go against us on that, although there's a slight chance that he might rule with us, because the only one he did side with us on was Dale versus Boy Scouts of America, and that was also a free speech case. So, but I'm predicting he's going to go against us.
Yeah, that was a long time ago.
That's the backstory.
He seems to have evolved. I don't disagree with you at all, Scott. I think your assessment is right on the mark. And I love just a personal anecdote. I was in my office in Washington, at CWA, when that Lawrence versus Texas decision was announced. And I remember running to the television in my office and sitting down, turning on Fox, and I saw not one, not two, but three attorneys all praising the decision, all of them on Fox. Yeah. And we immediately called Fox and said, fair and balanced? I don't think so. This morning, we're not hearing any pushback whatsoever. So that night, they asked me to go on Fox, which I did, which I used to be on television a lot. I wasn't working for Fox then. I was doing just television everywhere. And so...
No, I remember seeing you on I don't remember that particular night, but I know you were the voice at the time, standing for truth in Fox when no one else would do it.
Yes, and that happened a lot, and my staff too. But this is a little vignette that's not really relevant. It's just interesting. That night when I went on Fox, it was one of the worst treatments I'd ever gotten being on their channel. They kept me just sitting and waiting and waiting and waiting until the show was almost over, and then they finally came to me to make my quick remarks about why I thought Lawrence versus Texas wasn't a good ruling. And when they did that, mysteriously, my entire face turned green. Seriously, like the Wicked Witch on the Wizard of Oz. Seriously, I didn't know it.
Tricks.
And then when I got to my office the next morning, we watched the video. It was unbelievable. But as God would have it, Scott, how he works in mysterious ways. It was that incident that caused me to get acquainted with Bill Shine, the vice president of Fox, who later, when I left CWA, offered me a job as a pundit at Fox. And so, what man meant for evil, God meant for good. But that's that day. But moving, you came back to Massachusetts. That was it. Why did you do that?
Well, I didn't like the practice of law very much. I liked the constitutional law stuff. But the bread and butter was family law, very emotional. And I asked the Lord for a new assignment. My wife and I ended up doing a 50-city tour of the former Soviet Union, working with a Russian-speaking church based in Riga, Latvia, that had a mission to retake the cities for Christ in the Soviet Union. And then when we came back from that, I asked him for a city. He sent us to Springfield, Massachusetts, and we opened an inner-city mission there in Springfield with that very goal, and happened to be there from 2008 until the present. And so with 10 years of being in the darkest of the political arenas, as an outspoken pro-family Christian, suffering the consequences of it.
Yes, and you did. We have to talk about that for a second. I remember in our past discussions, it's been a long time since we actually talked, Scott, but you opened a coffee house where you opened your doors to the LGBT community, but anyone else who was struggling. But that ended up being a great amount of focus for your ministry. Describe that. I don't know if you still have the coffee house, but describe that ministry.
Yes, we do. As a matter of fact, Holy Grounds Coffee House is still open. It's a non-denominational church in the form of a coffee house. It serves the bottom strata of society, the mentally ill, drug addicts, homeless. Every day, a wonderful Bible study every morning. Sometimes 20, 30 homeless people are in there because they love it. And that became sort of ground zero in a campaign to re-Christianize the city of Springfield. But because it was Scott Lively who was doing this, the hard left in Massachusetts began doing everything that they could just to take me down, even though I wasn't touching the homosexual issue. I thought I've spent 20 years at that time on the topic. That's enough. I'm going to move on and do something a little bit more traditional Christian evangelism, etc. But Al Pacino and The Godfather, they just dragged me back in. And that's what happened. And I got sued for crimes against humanity, for preaching against homosexuality in Uganda, which is going to be my last public conference on the issue. And I thought, oh, it's in Africa, you know, no big deal. You know, I'll do it because I kind of owed, you know, I wanted to help them out, the Africans, because I'd been there a couple times before and they were really struggling. And then when I came back from there, they, just after I left, they came forward with a really harsh law that then I got blamed for. I got blamed to be the mastermind of. They started calling it the Kill the Gays Bill. And then I became an international pariah, and the Human Rights Campaign identified me as public enemy number one globally of the LGBT agenda. And so, you know, that sort of dragged me back into the issue. I wasn't going to back down. I wasn't going to run away from them. And so overnight I became really the chief spokesman for the biblical view of on LGBT issues around the world. It was just amazing.
It's funny how God works, Scott. I mean, it really is. It really is. That is just God's, that is the way he works. But the irony of you being public enemy number one to the Human Rights Campaign, which is, by the way, for those of you who don't know, the most incredibly funded pro-LGBT entity in the country. They've got millions and millions of dollars. They're behind
it. In the world.
Yeah, so it's a big deal to be named their public enemy number one and to be targeted by them. And so now, for you to be running for governor in the state of Massachusetts, I just have to stop and let people understand why this is an incredible story, that you got 28% of the delegates at the convention, and now you're going, God willing, will be on the ballot if they accept your signatures, and you'll be challenging and talking. I'm sure this will come up. You know it will. They're not going to let that die. That'll be
That's the focus. It's already the focus of hostility toward me by Mr. Baker and the RINOs. You know, I don't shrink from it, but at the same time, I'm not going to let it define me either, because I'm not single issue. And frankly, The homosexual-related aspects of public policy in Massachusetts are a fraction of a fraction of 1% of things that that a governor would have anything to do with. But there are so many other things that a biblical worldview is essential to approach things with, to solve them. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm not going to let them trap me in a box of being the anti-gay candidate. I'm gonna rise above that by just simply being a full spectrum conservative who doesn't shrink from anything I've ever written or said, but who then pivots from those things to the other issues like life and the Second Amendment. And I mean, I am a constitutional law attorney. I've got a greater breadth of personal experience than any candidate that's ever run for governor of Massachusetts, really. I've been to 58 countries. I've had 5 different careers. I've got training across the spectrum, from law to theology to human rights. And all this is by the grace of God, because I used to be an alcoholic and a drug addict who slept under bridges and begged for money on the streets. That's the other side of the diverse spectrum that the Lord, every single one of those things has been coalesced into the personality and skill set that I have today to bring into this battle for governor. And that's all glory to him. None to me. If it hadn't been for him, I'd be dead or in some kind of an institution or something.
Yes, I hear you. I want to ask you, not your personal story, although I'd love to hear it, but I want to ask you just in general. You grew up in Massachusetts, even though you were not there when the gay marriage law was passed. You grew up there. How would you describe that state when you were growing up? What was Massachusetts like?
Well, Massachusetts was like a different country. You know, we had, you know, it was really the epitome of the American dream. Shelburne Falls, where I was, an idyllic little New England village. You know, you could live on one income. The kids could go out and play. We did. You know, we'd leave in the morning, wouldn't come back till dark. Nobody was worried about it. The factories were humming. The economy was booming. The churches were full. The jails were empty. Nobody was shooting each other in the public schools. Never even heard of anything like that. And yet all that's flipped on its head now. You know, how? It's cultural Marxism. It's the challenge, the Judeo-Christian worldview that we all had as a consensus back in the 50s. Has been replaced by a secular humanist worldview, which is really the religion of Marxism, cultural Marxism specifically, and you know, we're now subject to a top-down government where everything is dictated to us from this extraordinarily totalitarian type elite, and the concept of local control and delegated powers to government, all those things that the founding fathers established have all been just kicked off to the side. And I want to reverse that, get back to where we were, get back to original intent of the Constitution, get back to smaller government, not just smaller government, and the whole package that used to make us so prosperous and secure.
Yes, and let me just add, while we have to take this break here, if people are wondering what cultural Marxism has to do with gay marriage, it has everything to do, because part of the goal of the Marxists was to completely destroy the family so that people would depend on government and not on family. So it's sexual anarchy. Yeah. That's part of cultural Marxism, and that's part of why that's been
that's right.
such a focus.
Yeah, They just don't realize that the sexual revolution is the primary tool of the global elite.
Okay, hold that thought. Hold that thought.
Yeah,
Dr. Scott Lively is my guest. We have to take a break, but when we come back, I'll let him finish that sentence. This is Sandy Rios in the Morning on AFR Talk.
You're listening to a best of edition of Sandy Rios in the Morning.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the Morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
This is a best-of edition of Sandy Rios in the Morning.
A bill targeting the conversion therapy of gay and lesbian individuals is now in the hands of the state Senate after passing the state assembly last week.
It's about time.
Assembly Bill 2943 would essentially aim to end the selling or advertising of any kind of conversion therapy service in the state of California.
Conversion therapy, for those who don't know, is the process by which people claim that they can change a person's sexual orientation or sometimes their gender identity or gender expression.
Local LGBTQ organization leaders gathered Tuesday afternoon for a town hall and responded to the bill, as well as the possibility of it becoming law.
I think anything that would help curtail the practice of reparative or conversion therapy and send the message that this is a harmful practice, I think is a good thing.
Leaders at the town hall telling 23ABC they did not want the faces of those attending the town hall on camera in order to preserve privacy, going on to say they believe this bill was a long time coming.
I just think there's too many people over generations who have suffered enough.
The practice, they say, something that from time to time they see locally and want to see gone.
It does come up a lot across the state and across the country. There are licensed clinicians who actively believe in this practice. There are religious leaders who believe that it's a choice.
In 2012, the state of California banned mental health providers from performing conversion therapy for those under 18. The bill would ideally ban the practice if it's charged on adults. Reporting in studio, Veronica Acosta, 23 ABC.
Interesting story. And of course, that brings us up to date with this whole issue of pressing the culture in every way to stop any kind of resistance to homosexuality, gay marriage, transgenderism, anything. California now is on the cutting edge themselves. The next frontier is shutting up any kind of opposition and criminalizing it. They say performing, reparative therapy, they're talking about just simply counseling people who are confused and maybe don't want to be homosexual or transgendered, whatever, you fill in the blanks, but making it, oh no, you can't dare tell them that there might be some other way. In fact, a biblical view, God's view of sexuality in the world, and that's what's happening in California. So even though gay marriage was legalized first in Massachusetts in 2004, and 3 years ago, nationwide, by our Supreme Court, who shall ever forget that day, it's not going to stop there. It is a march to the left that will not stop. Scott Lively is my guest. He is a candidate for governor in the state of Massachusetts. And Scott, that kind of lends to the point you were making about cultural Marxism and when we took the break. Can you finish your thought on that, please?
Yeah, I was saying the sexual revolution is the primary tool of the global elites to break the backbone, really, of sovereign nations, soften them up to be absorbed into a global socialist system. It's because what it does is it destroys the family infrastructure. And then the more you dissolve family bonds, the more chaos that you have. It's a self-evident truth. I wanted to address that the logic behind the clip that you're talking about, because it's an insult to intelligence. The arguments that they make, and just lock it in the way that they approach two different things: sexual orientation versus gender identity. So with sexual orientation, there is no objective criteria that anyone can point to that defines one's sexual orientation. It's really a subjective self-identification. There's no blood test, there's no gene test or anything. It's all just really a state of mind. I declare I'm gay, and therefore that's my sexual orientation. So the idea then that a person can reorient toward the design of their own body, an orientation that's consistent with their physiology, that's treated as if it's a ridiculous concept that's completely impossible. Now contrast that with the gender identity issue. Gender identity is a fixed and immutable condition. Every single human being has male or female physiology. There's only two genders, and it's obvious to any 5-year-old that stands naked next to somebody of the opposite gender. It's just, there's only two of us, and yet that fixed and immutable status is treated as fluid for the purpose of gender identity. So that your gender identity is something that you don't need any objective criteria. It's just how you feel. So they just simply, the logic is completely flipped on its head from one category to the next, and no one calls them on it. It's just, and that it exposes the complete ethical bankruptcy of journalism and academia and political leaders, because it's something that's so self-evident that it's the emperor's new clothes culture-wide.
Scott, I'm curious about something, you spent a long time in the Soviet Union, and I actually didn't. I was not there nearly as long as you. I was there for 3 weeks, and right before they broke, when Boris Yeltsin was running for president, it was right before the Soviet Union broke up. Anyway, my purpose was to do interviews with people, and it was right at the beginning of Glasnost, that openness, and they were just sort of learning stuff from the West that they'd never heard in their lives. And the focus often in the conversation was just a belief in God. They'd been taught there was no God for 60 years, and most of them believed it. At first, they just began to adapt, and they weren't hearing it in schools or on television or in textbooks or in science. It was just there was no God, but they were beginning to say... I had a neurologist say to me, she was telling me the history of autism and describing to me, that's the kind of kid she worked with, the scientific basis for it. And then I'll never forget this moment, unsolicited. She drifted off and sort of looked away from me, and she said, but we're beginning to think that maybe there is a God, which was just stunning. Okay, so my question for you is, you've got 14 years now in public schools, and even before that was a big deal in Massachusetts. It is. I'm picking on Massachusetts because that's your state, but they were the cutting edge of that. Sexuality is fluid. That maybe you're not female, maybe you're partly male, or that maybe you can't have just sex with a man. Maybe you should think about having it with a woman, or vice versa. That families can be different makeups, and et cetera, fill in the blank. Is truth still strong in Massachusetts, or do you think the delusion has taken over successfully?
Well, it's in California, like in Massachusetts, the effort to suppress truth is very vigorous. And kids today, that's one of the arguments for having a conservative in the primary, is that no one is expressing conservative perspectives to the young people. They don't get it at school. They don't get it from movies or TV or the news or the popular culture or music, any of it. And if the Republican Party, which is supposed to be the opposition party in a place like Massachusetts, doesn't articulate conservatism and why conservative perspectives are superior, and of course we're coming from a Judeo-Christian logical platform on all these things, then the kids never will hear it. That's why they're so far left. That's why their world is so chaotic. That's why there are shootings in the public schools. They have a culture in which God is absent. It's an atheistic sort of self-serving, get all the pleasure that you can in any way that you can, because that's the only thing that matters in life. That's the culture that they live in. They've never lived in a time when their peers weren't being slaughtered in abortion clinics and in the public schools. And they've never lived in a time where the popular culture wasn't cramming every kind of perversion that they can get away with down their throats 24/7.
So I'm guessing it's having its effect. And I mean, for those of you who have, I know your kids are not little anymore, like mine aren't. For parents now who still hold the biblical worldview and are still, still see things clearly, a truth, how do their children navigate the world in which, how do they help their children navigate this world in which they're finding themselves?
Well, Christian people find a way to live Christian lives, and some of them give in to some Christians are actually functional atheists. You know, they're functional secular humanists, because even though they might go to church, they actually just sort of capitulate on all the policies and they never stand up. But those who have an authentic biblical worldview, they make sure that their kids know what the biblical perspective is on things. They tend to be the people that will homeschool, or that will have a strong Christ-centered home life. And the salt and the light does work against the corruption of the world, and that's successful. There's 7,000 at least who haven't bowed the knee to Baal, and that's a symbolic reality wherever the Church of Christ is functioning, that's true. And there is a remnant everywhere of people who are believers in Yahweh, Yeshua HaMashiach, Jesus Christ, and are not ashamed of his gospel.
Yes. All right. So, Scott, are you still okay? Because, for instance, the LGBT community, because they've just been emboldened and affirmed, and they hardly ever hear any other story, any other resistance. Do you see God working in that community in spite of that? Do you see people coming to Christ? You see people coming out of the lifestyle? What's happening with that?
Well, that's what the ex-gay movement has really been so beneficial for, and that's why they're trying to stomp it out with these anti-conversion therapy laws, which are really grossly totalitarian. And frankly, one of my goals here in this campaign is I want to establish sort of a profile of what an authentic conservative homosexual looks like. Not at ever endorsing homosexuality because it's something condemned by God, but in the civic context and dealing with matters of public policy and civil rights, what is it that distinguishes someone who is authentically conservative in their political perspectives from the gay progressives? And that would be things like an emphasis on personal privacy instead of gay pride parades and cramming it down everybody's throats. And really, it sort of boils down to toleration versus celebration. That was the original goal of the gay movement back in the 1950s, and it morphed into a radical cultural Marxist warfare paradigm in the late 1960s. When they adopted Herbert Marcuse's cultural Marxist agenda. But before that, it was always, their pursuit was the right to be left alone. And that's something that all of us should endorse. We should respect people's right to be wrong, because in God's perfect timing, he works with every person. And as long as they agree that mainstream society should be and must be heterosexual, it must be centered on the natural family, and that kids have a human right to have a mom and a dad. As long as they can agree with those things, what choices they make in the privacy of their own bedrooms is something that our civil rights can accommodate. That's always been my perspective. I don't articulate that very often, but I think we have to be concerned at the state we're in right now, in terms of the gay cultural supremacy being driven by the hard left progressives, that that the natural family may actually be facing extinction, you know, especially if this if the transgender agenda is pushed through and the concept of male and female complementarity is actually becomes criminalized, because that's where this is headed. And so my actual focus now is shifting from the culture war model to a conservationist model. And I'm starting to make the argument across society that, look, we have to preserve the natural family as the central concept of civilization, or we're going to face some really serious problems, because the natural family is the ecosystem of humanity, and it needs far more than rainforests and tide pools and things like that. The natural family needs to be protected. For the health of society.
Yes, we're out of time. When is your primary?
September 4th, and we can have some more conversations along the way. I really enjoy talking with you.
Yes, I enjoyed this too, Scott, and I think our listeners will greatly benefit from what you've said today. Scott Lively, running for governor in the state of Massachusetts. Isn't that something? Isn't that something? Thank you, Scott, for your time today. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.